So first of all, let me thank the whole staff of the International Consortium for Research in Humanities, and especially Professor Herbes and Professor Lackner, for offering me this extraordinary opportunity to study in the Friedrich Alexander Universität Erlangen-Nürnberg and to participate in the research activities of the consortium. This is a privilege for me, so thank you very much. The paper I presented today is based on my current research about visionary literature and accounts of other world journeys in the medieval tradition, particularly in Germany. But before getting to the heart of the matter, it is worthwhile to provide a few introductory remarks on the subject and on the sources. Visions can be referred to as psychosomatic events through which a person experiences the transfer of his soul, with the help of a supernatural force, to another world where he or she receives a revelation. Meanwhile, the body remains asleep or in a state of ecstasy without any awareness of what is happening. By the word vision, a number of phenomena of knowledge are meant that can be brought down to a common denominator, as well as a wide-ranging and manifold literary genre. Visions can be arranged into different types, and a well-established taxonomy has been proposed in the seminal works by Peter Dinselbach. You can see in the handout that I have distributed in selected bibliography with the reference also to Dinselbacher's works. The visions of afterlife in Middle Ages involve a visual, palpable, tangible representation of the hereafter and of its different regions, heaven, hell, purgatory, and further interim places. They differ from the so-called ecstatic experiences, as for instance those belonging to the type of the Unio Mystica, which are attested from the 12th century onwards, and referring to the kind of visions like those of Mechthild of Magdeburg, for instance, which instead do not present any concrete image. And to a different category belong the phenomena of apparition through which a person feels the presence of a divine or supernatural being, such as the Virgin Mary or the devil, without entering a state of ecstasy. The images occurring in the visions of afterlife are, of course, closely connected to the daily experience of the protagonist, who introduces in his vision elements or aspects drawn from his personal life environment, just like it happens in dreams, and which are obviously different from each time and culture. So, for instance, the presence in a vision of a Dominican or Franciscan monk can be documented only from the 13th century onwards, clearly not before the foundation of these monastic orders. Many kinds of visions are witnessed in all times and cultures. The earliest traces of visionary literature can already be found in antiquity. I have provided a very short paragraph at the beginning of the handout of a list of visionary experiences documented and described in writings of antiquity. For example, in the closing section of his The Republic, Plato reports the myth of Er. It is an eschatological legend about the afterlife that greatly influenced religious, philosophical, and scientific thought for many centuries. The hero is a man named Er, who dies in battle. 10 days after his death, his body remains undecomposed. 2 days later, he revives on his funeral pyre and tells how was his journey in the afterlife, including an account of a reincarnation. And already in this tale, it was introduced the idea that moral people are rewarded while immoral people punished after death. And the result, there are also the judges, the set between different openings and order the soul which path to follow. Plutarch too related of a number of similar accounts of the afterlife. In The Demon of Socrates, he described the ecstatic experience of a man, a certain Marcus, and here the structure of the cosmos is divided into two spaces. Below, says Timarchus, there is an abyss shrouded in darkness and storm from which screams and moans uttered by men, women, children, and even animals came out. Accounts of the underworld travels occur also in the epic literature, such as the well-known story of Odysseus going to Hades to consult the seer Teiresias, the dead oracle, about his return, as well as the underworld adventures of Aeneas in the night to look for Dido. And in both narratives, the heroes meet figures of the past, relatives and friends. Nevertheless, these ancient texts do not seem to have exerted a direct and significant influence on the medieval visionary literature. In this regard, the eschatological writings of Jewish tradition, produced from 200 before Christ onwards, are much more relevant. A variety of apocryphal tradition and texts contain description of ascent to heaven, of eminent prophets or biblical figures, such as Baruch, Enoch, and Abraham. Most of these works are anonymous books written in Greek or Hebrew and are of uncertain provenance. A range of the most characteristic motifs of such apocrypha will occur in later visionary literature of the Middle Ages, such as the presence of the spiritual guide, mostly an angel, the ghost throne, the paradise mountain, the fiery valley, which occurs in the first book of Enoch, the seven heavens in the second book of Enoch and in the Apocalypse of Abram, the demons and the punishment by fire, occurring in the Apocalypse of Zephaniah. To this group, the Apocalypse of Ezra, so the fourth book of Ezra, also belongs. And of course, motifs of the afterlife feature in canonical biblical books, in both the Old Testament and the New, to begin with in the Revelation of John, of course. Among the legends of travel to the other world circulating in the early Middle Ages, the so-called Apocalypse of Peter plays a role, even though its influence on the later Western tradition is rather limited. This text, originally written in Greek, dating back to the middle of the second century, was for some time quite popular, to such an extent that it would appear to have run a considerable chance of achieving a place in the canon, but then it was rejected. This apocalypse reports a voyage of the Apostle Peter to paradise and hell with a guide of Christ. The revelation of Peter presents the earliest embodiment in Christian literature of those pictorial representations of heaven and hell, which then will exercise a widespread and enduring influence. But in its imagery, it has little or no kinship with the Book of Daniel, for example, Book of Enoch, or other Jewish books. Instead, it shows many parallels with the representations of the afterlife found in the Greek beliefs. So, for example, with the vision of Ur that we have mentioned before. Among the early Christian apocalypses and the legends of travels to the other world circulating in the early Middle Ages, a special place must be accorded to the Apocalypse of Paul, or Visio Pauli. That is because of its exceptional popularity, wide circulation, and rich history of reception, particularly through its influence on Dante's Divine Comedy. The text is stuffed with an abundance of reminiscence of classical, Jewish, and Christian materials, and indeed it is a receptacle of earlier traditions and at the same time a fountainhead of themes and images of later texts. The book was probably composed in Greek in the 4th century AD, likely in Egypt, and soon after translated into Coptic, Syriac, Armenian, Georgian, Arabic, Ethiopic, and Latin. In the Middle Ages, many daughter translations into the different vernacular languages were also produced, and revised forms of the ancient versions appeared. So in the West alone, it has been possible to discern no less than 11 medieval Latin reductions. According to Juruskova, which in 2006 has published an edition of the whole Western tradition, it is possible to distinguish two different directions, two different traditions. The Eastern tradition, which includes the reductions containing both the description of heaven and hell, and which can more properly be called the Apocalypse of Paul. And the Western tradition, including mostly the Latin versions and the vernacular translation and adaptation, which present essentially the description of hell, and that can be defined as Visio Pauli. The text describes the heavenly voyage undertaken by the Apostle Paul with the guard of the Archangel Michael. And during his afterlife adventure, Paul passes through the places of judgment of human souls, an earthly region called the Promised Land, the heavenly city of Christ, the regions of hell and paradise. Some reductions of the Western text tradition open with a prologue containing the account of a miraculous finding of the Apocalypse of Paul in Tarsus, in a marble box hidden in the house where St. Paul had lived. Such discovery should have occurred at the time of the consulship of Theodosius Augustus the Younger, so it was probably in the year 420. The work expands the well-known passage contained in the second epistle to the Corinthians, that I have also reported in the handouts. It must be. Can I have a handout? So the second point of the handout. And this passage sometimes is also included in like an epigraph in several reductions, and usually it is included in the prologue too. I will read very quickly the passage, so to introduce to the topic. St. Paul says, "It is not expedient for me doubtless to glory. I will come to visions and revelations of the Lord. I knew a man in Christ above 14 years ago, whether in the body I cannot tell, or whether out of the body I cannot tell, God knoweth, such and one caught up to the third heaven. And I knew such a man, whether in the body or out of the body, I cannot tell, God knoweth, how that he was caught up into paradise, and heard unspeakable words, which it is not lawful for a man to utter. Of such an one will I glory, yet of myself I will not glory, but in mine infirmities." The voyage to Paul, to the underworld, is structured in various thematic sections. Chapters 3-6 present an appeal of the sun, moon, stars, sea, and earth to God above man, which is actually a protest of all natural elements and celestial bodies against the human race that only sins. Chapters 7-10 contain the daily reports of the angels to God about man's good and wicked deeds. Chapters 11-18 include the death and judgment of a righteous and a wicked person, so a real trial. Chapters 19-35 describes Paul's vision to paradise, where he meets a number of biblical figures, beginning with Enoch and Elijah, and at this stage of the travel, he's conducted from the third to the second heaven in the land of promise, that is a land of marvelous fertility, with a river flowing with milk and honey, and trees full of fruits and grapevines with 10,000 branches. In chapter 29, Paul visits a heavenly city that has several features of the heavenly Jerusalem, which is also described in the Revelation of John, where also the four rivers of paradise, like in Genesis, flow, designated as the rivers of honey, milk, oil, and wine. And near the river of honey, Paul meets the prophets Isaiah, Ezekiel, Amos, Micah, and Zechariah. Near the river of wine, Paul meets Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Lot, Job, and other saints. Chapters 31 until 44 contain the description of Paul's vision of hell. The punishments here described are analogous to those of the Orphic Pythagorean scenes of the underworld, including fire, mud, blood, hanging in different positions and from different members of the body, tortures by beasts, walking on sharp objects, eating each other like serpents, and being roasted. But many other horrible details of tortures in the Apocalypse of Paul are not found in previous literature, such as the piercing of bowels with the hook, hitting the people with stones and wounding the face, worms proceeding from the mouth and nostrils, cutting the lips and the tongue with a fiery razor, wearing barney chains in the neck, sitting in ice and snow, sitting in a pit of pitch and sulfur. Here Paul sees also the ocean, which surrounds all the earth, and at the outer limit of the ocean, he saw a place surrounded by darkness and sorrow, where he saw a river of fire. And in the river, there are a multitude of men and women immersed up to the knees, but other men up to the navel, up to the lips, and moreover up to the hair. In the last two chapters of this section, there is a hope, because Michael and Paul, so together, together with his guide, obtain for the damned a sort of favor, because they obtain that on the day of Christ's resurrection, the damned will be given a day of refreshment, of repose from the torments of hell. And this is a theme, a motif which will occur in later representations of the afterlife. So this day of refreshments of the damned because of the mercy of God. In the last two chapters of this section, we have said that. So then there is the last section from chapters 45 to 51 that contains a second vision of paradise. A number of reductions contains this second vision. The reductions are very different from each other's. Some reductions contain this second visit, some others no. But here Paul has again paradise, the visit to paradise of Genesis, including the four rivers, the tree of life, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And again, he meets a lot of people, biblical figures, and the Virgin Mary, and biblical saints. It must be noted that the Apocalypse of Paul, refers to the judgment of the individual soul immediately after the separation from its body, and not to the last judgment foreseen at the end of the world. In the Apocalypse of Paul, there is also a very interesting stress on a distinction between the impious, so impi, and the sinners, peccatores. A distinction that is already made clear by Gregory, because the impious are those who are completely outside the faith, whereas sinners accept Christianity as a creed, but do not confirm to its principles. So in the Apocalypse of Paul, there is the distinction between sinners and impi, and sinners can have still the possibility to be saved. While the heathens, the unconverted, this is said because the unconverted, of course, the impious, are condemned to the eternal fire. The Apocalypse of Paul suffered the destiny of many other apocryphal works. It was rejected by leading church figures, but remained in use in monastic and other circles. Augustine opposed it strongly in his treatise on John, if only it describes at length what was called in the second epistle to Corinthians, things which must not and cannot be put into human language. And it is also included among the works banished in the Decretum Gelasianum, the Gelasian Decree. Also Sozomen in his Historia Ecclesiastica has attacked the Apocalypse of Paul. Nevertheless, the Apocalypse of Paul enjoyed enormous success and exerted great influence on the medieval apocalyptic and literature. Even Dante seems to refer to this when, at the beginning of the second canto of his Inferno, he evokes earlier description of a visit to the other world with the words, "Io non Enea, non Paulo son, I'm neither Aeneas nor Paul." Let's go to see now the German visionary traditions in the Middle Age that starts already in the Carolingian time. A number of visions of afterlife are attested, which can be interpreted also in a political key in the Carolingian time. The vision of Vetti, Visio Vettini, is the first of a line of Carolingian visions. Is a Latin prose version made in the 9th century, so in 824, by Heito, abbot at Reichenau. A verse rendition is also known and was made by Walafrid Strabo in 827. In the vision, it is related of the spiritual experience of Wettin, president of the monastic school of Reichenau. The day before his death, Wettin, who was very ill, saw in a vision bad and good spirits. The evil spirit came in the shape of a priest and was very ugly, with a dark face and without eyes. Other evil spirits then came, but then he was saved by the angel. The angel then took him through hell and showed him all the torments of the sinners and the joys of the saints. In this vision, we found the division of the other world into the three regions of hell. In the two regions of the underworld, hell, purgatory, and heaven. And also the criterion of the correspondence between fault and penalty. It is also the presence of public figures of the time, and there is also a severe judgment of the author against the corruption of powerful men, as well as against the worldliness of the clergy. Hato did not use any name, but the verse rendition of Alfred Strabo uses acronyms in the initial letters of sequential verses to identify the protagonists. Among the souls suffering temporary punishments, waiting for salvation, Wettin includes also Charlemagne, punished for his carnal sins, of course. And the allusion to Charlemagne is confirmed by the acrostic of Alfred Strabo's verse reduction. So now we can read the point three in the end out, the passage regarding Charlemagne. Illic etiam quennam principem, qui Italia et populi Romani sceptra quondam rex erat, vidisse sestantem dixerat, et verenda eius cuistam animalis morsu laniari, reliquo corpora immuni ab ac lesione manente. Stupore igi turbementi attonitus, ammirans quomodo tantus vir, qui in defensione cattoliche fidei et regimine sancta ecclesia moderno seculo, pene inter ceteris singularis apparuit, in uri tanta deformitate pene potuissent. Cui ab angelo ductore suo, protinus responsum est, quo, quamis multa miranda et laudabilia et deo accepta fecisset, quorum mercede privandus non est, tamen stupri in lecebris resolutus, cum ceteris bonis deo platis longevitatem vite sue in hoc terminare voluisset, ut quasi parva obscenitas concessa fragilitati umane libertas mole tantorum bonum obri et absum impotuissent, qui tamen inquit in sorte electorum ad vitam predestinatum est. So, moreover, he said that he saw a certain prince standing there, who once assumed the sovereignty of Italy and of the Roman people. His private parts were molded and beaten by an animal, while the rest of the body remained immune from such torture. Struck by great astonishment, he wondered how it was that such a man, who in the modern world had looked so extraordinary among others in defense of the Catholic faith and in the rule of the Holy Church, could be labeled by a so indecent penalty. At once, the angel who was guiding him answered that he had done a lot of things welcomed by God, praiseworthy and admirable, for which he could not be deprived of his reward, and still, enervated by his sexual pleasures, he wanted to close his long life this way by offering to other good deeds to God, almost as a light lewdness and the freedom allowed to the human frailty could be buried and deleted by so a great deal of good actions. Nevertheless, he said, he is predestined to the fate of the elect in eternal life. So our Charlemagne will be saved in the end. In Germany, during the High Middle Ages, the interest in eschatological themes grows in an intellectual background which is characterized by a general reform movement concerning every expression of culture and spirituality. The theological speculation developed the issues linked with the afterlife, and the apocalyptic tradition found expressions in various genres and textual forms. An interesting work stemming from this cultural milieu is the Liber Visionum, a collection compiled around the middle of the 11th century by a German monk named Otlo, linked somehow with the circle of Regensburg, and particularly to the monastery of St. Emmeram. The Liber Visionum gathers a number of visionary experiences lived by the author himself, mostly short apparitions and dreams, together with others which he was told by his brethren, relatives, and with some visions of the preceding centuries, like that of the monk Wenlock, reported by Boniface in his Epistle 115, and those reported by Bede the Venerable in his Historia Ecclesiastica Gentis Anglorum, including the vision of Drichtelm, which was a monk associated with the monastery of Melrose, so a real anthology. The Liber Visionum of Otlo testifies to the penchant towards the visionary and afterlife literature of the monastery of Regensburg, one of the most active and dynamic cultural centers of Germany in this time. Let's go now to have a look to the reception of Visio Pauli in Germany and to the German version of the Visio Pauli. To the oldest version. The middle high German version of the Visio Pauli dates back to circa 1115 and survives in a fragmentary form in a double folio, in a bifolio, a double leaf parchment bifolio, preserved in Vienna in the Österreichische Nationalbibliothek. It was probably used as a paste down in the binding of a 15th century volume containing an editions of Pliny's Historia Naturalis. The poem then is followed in the double leaf by another verse composition concerning a similar topic and entitled Future After Death. So I have both reported a piece of the version of the Middle High German version of the Visio Pauli and a piece of Future After Death from the Zukunft nach dem Tode in the handout. The German fragment of the Visio Pauli reports the scene in which the angel shows to the apostle the door of heaven's fortress and an interim place where a group of souls are hung from trees which are shaken by a tempest. And this episode corresponds to chapters 23 and 26 of the Latin version. Now we can read the point number four. And so please, I have to apologize for my pronunciation of German of the 12th century. Do Sanctus Paulus der Guote in der Burg beschauet hätte, die manich falten ehre, da his in der Engel Heere, als er hin warten, in gegen der Burg porten. Das täter sa, do beschauet er da, vor der Burg frone manige Bäume schone. Die hatten nie keine Frucht mehr, wann das sie gelobet waren. Sie waren michel und große. Ufe den Bäumen saßen viel Wip und Mann mit michelen Noten befangen. Sie forchten ihn viel starke, die Bäume wageten viel harte, dass sie wehnen wollten, dass sie hier zu fallen sollten an der Stunde in das fräßlichen Abgrund. Sie mochten wollen die Burg gesehen, als sie jemanden darin sahen gehen, so wehneten sie viel heißer, dass sie darin nicht mussten gehen. So when St. Paul the good man had witnessed in the city the manifold honors, the lordly angel commanded him thus to make his way to the gate of the city. This he did accordingly. Then he saw there, in front of the splendid city, many a fake tree. These bore no fruit anymore, beyond the covering of leaves. They were mighty and great. Upon the trees sat many women and men, caught with great troubles. They were extremely afraid. The trees shook most violent from side to side, so that they were ready to believe that they would be bound to fall at the very moment in that dreadful death. They could see clearly into that city. Whenever they saw anyone enter therein, they wept burning tears that they themselves were not permitted to enter there. In this passage, there is a mention of the abyss, das fräßliche Abgrund, so the dreadful depths in line 11, that is the deepest part of the hell, where the damned were confined for the eternity. There was a distinction based on location criteria between an upper hell and a lower hell. And generally, the upper hell was a place of temporary and purgatorial fire, while the lower was the place of the eternal fire and damnation. This distinction derives already from Psalm, from the Psalm 85, where the psalmist says, "You have rescued my soul from the lower hell." Augustine interpreted the soul, the psalm, saying that perhaps there is an upper hell where the souls of the blessed enjoy peace, and a lower hell where the souls of the damned are tortured. And over a century and a half later, Gregory I confirms Augustine's interpretation, saying that there are both higher and lower places in hell, and that must be believed. And the Pope declares also that such, that the just, so the good people repose in the higher ones, and the wicked into the lower ones. This is in Morale Niob. After this passage, the Vienna Bifolio has a lacuna, and the missing text can be resolved with the help of the Latin versions of the Visio. Michael explains which were the sins of the people hanging from the trees. He says they were good people, but still not totally purified and worthy to enter into paradise. Their main fault was the pride that prevented them from being merciful and generous to their neighbor. Now they have to stay there until the doomsday in this interim place located between the heaven's door and the abyss. And then I will continue to read. Das sprach der heilige Bote, das kommet von Michael Gnaden Gottes, dem sie manich dienes taten, ob sie es wohl behalten hatten, jedoch skulen sie es nicht verloren haben, das sie durch in Hand getan. Das durch hat sie hier verlernt, Christ, wann hier der Ingang ist, aller seiner Tote, dass sie diese wenige Liute dazu Hoffnung haben, dass sie zum jüngsten Tage ihr Gewöhnliches genießen, dass man sie in die Burg ließe. So the Holy Messenger then said, that comes from the great mercy of God, for whom they have performed many services, if they have preserved it properly. And yet they shall not have done it in vain, that which they have done on his behalf. Therefore Christ has left them here, for here is the entrance for all his faithful followers, so that these wretched people should have then as their hope that they, at the day of judgment, will have the benefit of their assistance, so that they will be admitted to that city. This is clearly a place for purification after death, for those who die in God's grace and friendship, but are not totally purified in the holiness necessary to enter heaven. This is a sort of temporary punishment, a prelude to the concept of purgatory, which was gradually developing in those centuries. The second poem, in the Vienna Bifolio, has been named Future After Death, so Von der Zukunft nach dem Tode. This work develops a literary model which was quite popular in the Middle Ages, namely the comparison between the evil soul coming to hell and the good one going to heaven. The evil soul is captured by Satan and is conducted to hell, where there is alternately burning hot and freezing cold. A horde of demons carry the evil soul in a valley full of worms, sulfur and pitch, wrapped in a thick darkness. At this point, the soul reproaches harshly the body, casting up all the sinful deeds committed during the earthly life, robbery, homicide, and other horrible actions. And then we will continue to read the point 4 of the handout. Do quimid der tiefele scare, der ist ein grosse gare, sie fuhren sie, die Seele, in ein Tal, das ist gewurmis so voll, Svebeles und Beches, maniges Ungemaches. So sieht sie in einem Bliche, ein Finster, also Diche, dass man sie mochte griefen, so beginnet sie lute rufen, viel lute ruft sie, o weh, quantes und tenebre, der Tiefel nimmet die Seele, viel lute ruft sie umere, so weh mir, dass je besaß das viel reine Fass, nun hast du mich verraten, ich, was ich Gottes Atem des himmlischen Königes. So then comes the host of the devils, which is a huge multitude. They bring the soul to a valley that is full of worms, sulfur and pitch, and of great sorrow. Then suddenly she sees so a thick darkness that one might grasp it. Then she starts to shout aloud. Out loud she cries, oh, ve quante sunt tenebre. The devil takes the soul and she cries more aloud. Woe is me, as I always possessed this impure body. Now you have betrayed me, albeit I was created by God's breathing of the heavenly king. Totally different is, of course, the fate of the good soul. That is led like a bride in the holy city by the guardian angel, who is in turn likened to a bridegroom, while angelic choirs welcomed her with celestial songs and some a wedding ceremony, not a funeral. The theme of the contrast between a wicked and a good soul, as well as the debate between the soul and this body, is quite popular throughout the Middle Ages. In this regard, it is possible to find a number of parallels with a work which also enjoyed great success within the religious and encyclopedic tradition of the medieval Europe, namely the Elucidarium, considered to have been written by Honorius of Thon around in 1098, and of which also a number of German versions survive. The Elucidarium is a textbook of theological instructions because it elucidates the obscurity of various things, structured in the form of a dialogue between a teacher, so the magister, and a pupil, the discipulus, discussing questions of theology, biblical history, cosmography, geography, and ethnography. It is divided into three books. The first discusses God, the creation of angels and fall, the creation of man and his fall, and the need of redemption, as well as the earthly life of Christ. The second book discusses the divine nature of Christ, and then the third book is devoted to Christian eschatology with the Antichrist, the Second Coming, the Last Judgment, Purgatory, the pains of hell, and the joys of heaven described in vivid detail. There is a special focus on questions concerning the afterlife and the destiny of the soul after death and in its separation from the body. Particularly striking is also the presence in the Elucidarium of the simile of the wedding ceremony to describe the scene in which the good soul arrives to paradise. In German, the visionary material finds expression in other literary works produced still in the 12th century, among which the so-called Visio Tunug Dali emerges for the intense vividness of its images, as well as for its wide dissemination and influence exerted on later representations of the hereafter. This text presents an account of a voyage to the underworld, supposed to have been undertaken by an Irish nobleman. And the Latin original was written down in the monastery of St. James in Regensburg, around in 1149. The author reports to have heard of this visionary experience from Tungdal himself, and to have translated the story from Irish into Latin at the request of the abbess of Regensburg. The visual Tunugdali circulated widely in medieval Europe and was translated from the original Latin into many vernacular languages. The work became increasingly popular also in Germany, with 10 different translations into German and 4 into Dutch. The visual Tunugdal tells of the arrogant knight Tundal falling unconscious in a state of apparent death, a sort of catalepsy, for 3 days. And during this time, his soul is carried by an angel to heaven and hell, experiencing on his own skin — it is a bit contradictory, of course, because he says it is in soul, but then on his own skin, so it's very corporal — he suffers the pains, the punishments of hell. It is but after his 3 days, Tunugdal returned to take possession of his body, convert into a pious life of devotion and prayer. The visual Tunugdali is a receptacle of themes and images of visionary voyage to the other world. It is impossible to mention them all in their totality. Remarkable is the image of the narrow bridge suspended on a pit of fire and sulfur. In this pit of fire and sulfur, there are the proud, which are immersed, and this bridge, which is suspended, can be crossed only by the blessed souls. Tunugdal must have crossed also a similar bridge suspended on a lake. The bridge is long, narrow, and sharp, leading a wild cow. In his earthly life, he once had stolen his neighbor's cow, and so for this reason he had to expiate this sin in his vision. The theme of the bridge is quite disseminated, is quite well known in the afterlife and in the visual literatures, and is quite old, and also is already ultimately derived from Gregory's the Great Dialogi. The structure of hell in the Visio Tunugdali is divided into distinct sections. A first region consists of various natural elements, which are really pictorial described. Lakes, valleys, mountains, and is populated by a number of monstrous beasts. And here the sinners are distributed according to their different folds. The second section is an abyss, a chasm, the bottom of which is the dwelling of Lucifer, of whom the vision to Nogdali offers a quite elaborate portrait. We could say also that the vision to Nogdali is the first to offer a clear and very detailed representation of Lucifer. Satan inflicts horrendous pains and is simultaneously tortured by the pains he inflicts, even as he is bound fast until the last judgment, so that he will not cast the world into chaos. So now, moving to the conclusion of this paper, I would like to pinpoint just a few basic questions. The geography of the afterlife was one of the main concerns of the medieval theology and the eschatological literature. The realms of the underworld, paradise, hell, purgatory, and other interim regions are those places where the soul is believed to dwell during the time lapse in between the separation from the body and doomsday. And therefore, they are also interpreted as allegories of the fate of human beings after death. The importance attributed to the destiny of the souls is strictly connected with the necessity of repentance, which is a crucial aspect of the medieval visionary literature. The literary production in Germany in the early as well as the High Middle Ages is also involved in the development of apocalyptic narratives and visionary representations of the other world, both in Latin and in the vernacular. The eschatological tradition developed in Germany found expression in various genres and textual forms. And such cultural trend shows the great value which was assigned to the belief of the afterlife in medieval Germany, and which can be clearly understood because of its significant impact on the cultural, religious, social, and even political dimension. Thank you.